suggesting that we run something slightly different from just having work in progress, and that these colloquials can be more interactive than people doing their presentations and that sort of thing, even though those things are important. But I was really happy when he offered to do this, because he's got a vast amount of experience and I think takes a fairly sensible approach to these things. So may I welcome you, Graham.
Oh, thank you, Paul. Well, look, the purpose of talking about this topic tonight was based on the belief that if you've given a fair amount of thought to how to structure and write a thesis right at the very beginning of your research, it can actually make the process more efficient rather than try to do a lot of work and then write it all up later on. And so that was the argument. Now, I've tried to concentrate initially on theses that involve some empirical data collection. I believe that that sort of thesis is actually easier than one that's exclusively philosophical, analytical. They're hard because you don't have the same structure to support you and or, in a sense, prescribe the things that you've got to do. You have to create more structure for a philosophical thesis. And that's why I wouldn't attempt to write some general pattern for a philosophical thesis, because you can't do that. It depends a lot on whether you're doing something that's historical or whether you're doing something that's looking at principles and issues, or whether you're doing an analysis of documentary content and so on. So how many of you would be thinking at this stage of doing something that's empirical, collection of some sort of data? That tends to be the majority. Even if you're not going to do that, I think it's valuable to understand how you would do an empirical thesis, because it contrasts with one that's more philosophical and analytical. So I probably will get to that towards the end, but I hope that some of the ideas I want to suggest about how to write it and how to put it together might carry over to other sorts of theses. Now, what I'll be looking at is a system that I've found useful and helpful for the people that I've worked with. It may be a little idiosyncratic, but I do think it has some generalizability to it. But don't think that this is something that I would want to try to impose or prescribe. But I think if you get an idea of how it holds together, if you were doing something different, you could see, well, I'd need to change because I'm not doing the same thing here and I'm doing something different there. So it gives you at least something against which you can compare what you're going to do. And I would suggest also, right at the start of research, that you have a look at some people's theses. You don't have to read them all, but get a look at them and say, well, I can do that. Or, hell, I've got a lot more to do to get up to standard. Either way, I think it's valuable to do that, to get some idea of where you're going. Now, one of the ideas that I'd like to suggest for part of tonight, and I'd like to make a bit of a presentation and then talk about all the issues and have a lot of interaction over things later, is that you can imagine yourself as not just writing an assignment in a master's program, but you've got to tell the story of work that you're doing over 5 or 6 years. It's more difficult. And if you think of each chapter as like a different genre of book, it's like you need to be a different sort of author for each chapter that you do. And I find that's been helpful to people, because sometimes they write everything the same way. Chapter one's the same as the literature review, same as the data, so that each chapter has a very different function or role to play, and it requires some conforming to the prevailing research culture about how you write it up, whether you like it or whether you're not. For example, the writing up of empirical theses follows an old scientific paradigm where the first scientific papers would have an introduction, then you'd have materials and methods, results and discussion. And so what happens is it seems to have established very strongly this principle that you report all the data objectively without trying to say what you think it really means. The discussion of that should come later. And there's a great temptation when you're writing up the reporting the data to jump in and say what's important, what's significant, and that sort of thing. You have to resist that temptation. Now, the best way to resist that, I suggest, is you write the last three chapters at the same time. Not exactly that, but when you're putting your data down, if you get some brilliant insights, wow, this is the really big issue that's coming out of that, write a bit about the issue that you are going to slot into your next chapter. Put it in a different colour or put it in a different file, but it's handy to keep the things together. And then the other thing that I'll try to suggest is when you come to the last chapter, it's where you are writing about, well, so what? In the light of having done this whole thesis, what do I think really needs to happen in this field? And so it's like the big picture conclusions. The previous chapter, where you're talking about the meaning and significance of your data, is tied to the data. You know, it's sort of still got a... It's like a balloon, but it's still got links to explaining what you put in the data. But in the last chapter, you let loose from that and you don't use the word the data said or the teacher said, or you're now talking in big generalizations and making some sorts of conclusions. So that's the thrust of what I wanted to suggest, and that's where the idea of writing different books, different author, different style helps, because you need to be able to see those last three chapter bits together. There's the data, this is what it means, and these are the big conclusions I'm going to draw from it. I find some people get to the last chapter and they're exhausted, they've had it, they don't have the mental agility to think about the big issues temporarily. And so what they end up doing is just summarising what was in their previous chapter. You know, these are the main conclusions, without punching anything home. So I would suggest that you don't leave that task until the very end. You do the last three chapters almost concurrently and have a different colour for what you write. You probably will change it. You might throw it out later. But if you get something down, it means that you're capturing something of the original enthusiasm that you get when you see that data, and I have found with people that's very, very helpful. Okay, now just to explain the bits of paper, the first one is a little bit old now, a year or two old, but it's some general notes on how you might structure an empirical thesis. Now I won't refer to that very much. I'll try to talk through the material in number two. And that's explaining what are the different emphases, the different styles, the different conventions you need to keep consistent with when you write the different chapters. Now, number three, I've made up an artificial example here of a topic, and the topic is how religious ecclesiastical terms can cause problems for religious education. In other words, there are so many terms like in the Catholic sector, like catechesis, evangelization, mission, ministry, witness, shared praxis, faith formation. With all these things rolling around in your head, you can become confused, to say the least. And so what I've got there is an example of how you'd raise that issue in chapter one, what you do about it in the literature review, how you put in some questions that'll get information about it in your methodology, the results, what you might get, and how to write it up, particularly in those last two chapters. So if we had time, we might look at that. If not, that's just an artificial example. Half the references are made up. I just tried to make it look like it's just one little area that you might treat. Now, number four is about the use of headings. I find in a number of the students I have, they tend to write like a bee collecting pollen. I mean, bit of this, bit of that, bit of this, bit of that. And they've got all the ideas, but it's in a terrible jumble. And if they can superimpose some sort of logical, systematic structure by picking headings and organising what they write under that, they end up doing a much better job. And I've given some examples there of what it looked like initially, you know, the pollen collected stuff, and then what the headings look like after we'd gone through a bit of turmoil, you know, to get it right. And then the last one, number five, is another example of the same problem where somebody wrote up their abstract for the thesis, and I think it's a bit all over the place. You know, it's a bit of this, a bit of that. And on the right-hand side is how she finally wrote it up with a lot more structure and logic to it, where there's almost a function for each paragraph. What am I doing in this paragraph? What am I doing? Whereas with the other one, sometimes she's reporting a bit of data, sometimes she's referring to the literature, sometimes she's saying what she thinks the CEO ought to do about it, and if they're all mixed up, it's confusing. So they're the things that we'll try to work through. Okay, now firstly, if I say something about the first chapter of a thesis, and this will be, this would apply to both an empirical and a non-empirical one. When I first started research supervision, I tended to think, well, the first chapter, you write that at the end of the whole show. So, you know, because you know what you've done then, and so you can look like you know what you're doing if you write it last. Now, I think I've changed 360 degrees from that now. I think that if you write a good chapter one draft, it really makes a difference to the coherence of the whole thesis. If you're trying to scratch together what you think you ought to be doing at the end of the thesis, I think it's evidence that you haven't really been clear enough on what you should be doing. And so I would argue now that get that right. It's got to be right, and it's got to read well. If your examiner likes your first thesis, you've got him or her, if you know what I mean. If your first chapter is, oh, what does this mean? Where's it going? I've got no idea what this is about. You've got an uphill task getting your examiner on side. Now, also, the abstract of your thesis has got to be really spot on. I don't think you have to try to create a false impression. You're not trying to seduce people. But what you're trying to do is make it so clear that the examiner knows exactly what you're on about. In other words, don't get in the way between the examiner and your stuff. Good writing is something that doesn't have a noticeable style to it. It doesn't irritate the reader in any way. It allows the reader direct access and interaction with what you've got. You know, it's like a good Hollywood movie. In the classical Hollywood movie, they're edited in a way that you don't notice the editing. Do you understand it? But it does everything to get you more emotionally engaged with the story. And it's only if you become a film critic you see why they do this and why the music stops when it gets very tense and all that sort of thing. And if it's good, you don't notice that at all because you're totally engaged. And the best style is something that is simple, straightforward, doesn't use complicated jargon words, and your reader knows what you're on about. They may disagree, that's not the question, at least they know what you mean. And if in doubt, play it back. Read it onto a tape recorder, or read it and let some other person listen to it, And if it doesn't sound smooth and clear, then you've got to go back and do some homework. And often, you know, short sentences, shorter paragraphs with just one or two ideas in each, it may sound like you're teaching Year 9 kids to write essays, but sometimes when people get to this level, and I know I've had this problem all my life, you tend to write like a structural engineer. Everything is correct and exact, but it's burdensome. And I've always had that problem. When I was in Year 11, I remember the first essay that I wrote, and you know, I handed this thing in and it came back and it had written on it, "This reads like a third-rate politician's first speech." And it was quite right, and I've been struggling with that ever since. But so I probably paid back a few students by saying something like that to them, and says a lot of people have paid the price for my humiliation, but I think it's punishment in a noble cause. It's not personal or anything like that. So I think these things are terribly important, because if you get a thesis that's turgid and repetitive and uses too many words, it gets irritating. And the last thing you want to do is irritate your examiner. And I think a type of style that's not evident, that's clear and simple and straightforward, really helps. Okay, now, what do you need to do in Chapter 1? Well, I've suggested a few things there. I suggest that you start off with something a bit general, and you toss in a few marker references to locate the general area that you are going to work in. It might be, say, the spiritual and moral dimensions to Australian education. There are some public documents. Then you say, now, Catholic schools have always attended to this area. So you've gone from the general to the Catholic. Then you might say, and the special area of interest in this study will be on retreats as a distinctive feature of Catholic school religious education. So you sort of zero in a little bit in your first few paragraphs, and you might say, just very generally, this thesis is about retreats, without specifying. So right at the start, although the reader should have read the abstract first, but you put that in. Then I think the next task is you need to indicate what are some of the significant issues or problems or questions that this is the general area that you're going to investigate. Now, when you do this, remember, you've got to do this in a lot more detail in the literature review. So you just have to raise the question. You have to put in one or two references to highlight some of these, and it's problem posing, it's issue raising, it's noting questions that can be asked about this, and you may have one or two of these, you might have five or six of them, to say that, well, here's a cluster of issues that have been identified in the literature. Another thing you might do is say, well, here's an issue and there's nothing written about it, or very little about this. You know, you might say it's quite surprising that Catholic diocesan guidelines always talk a lot about witnessing, but they never explain what the hell they mean by it. Does it mean that you go and you pummel students with your own views? You know, that's just a side, but it's a matter of raising issues and so on. And then I think that implied in this comes out of it, this area merits research. You have to, sometimes you can say, this is one question your thesis will study, but if you say that at the end of every heading, it gets repetitive. All you've got to do is highlight the issues here. By implication, later you'll say, this study will address all of these issues above, and this is the main research question. So you need to avoid saying, well, this is a really important issue. You've just got to demonstrate its importance. Now, this is an aside. I've encountered a lot of trouble with the people that I've worked with over the years, because they were given a set structure for writing up their research proposal, and it had all these headings that you had to have in them. I think they were stupid headings. For example, they'd have the significance of the area, the importance of this study, the context, and then after all these headings you might say, well, put in now what you're going to do. And I found that when people come to write their thesis, they couldn't get this out of their system, and they tend to do the same thing. And in the research proposal, I say, well, you've got to explain who you are and where you're coming from, so people would have a whole little life story put in about themselves. Now, that might be all right in a research proposal, but I would think that that's been problematic for enough people to scrap that and say the research proposal structure's got to be exactly the same as the thesis, with the exception that you won't have the data and you won't have the... the same sort of thing, an introductory chapter, a literature review, a methodology, and then maybe at the end a timeline or something. But I've had, I can count four or five people, and I had to fight with them and say, look, get this research proposal out of your system. You're not doing a research proposal now. This is a better structure. And so I'm a bit aggressive about this, but I would think that if you are to submit a research proposal, and you haven't done that yet, follow this structure exactly, or something like this, so that you're trying out at writing your thesis. If you do it well enough, you might have some bits you can use, particularly this first chapter.
I'm glad you said that, Graham, because I found myself being, in a sense, a bit repetitive, and I thought,
it's terribly repetitive. I don't know what they're using now, but the one that we had from about 1997 to about 2003, I had to stop people from using it that I work with, because I found it a problem. You know, it emphasised things that I think shouldn't have been in the thesis. And
can I just clarify? The way you use the word thesis,
yeah.
What do you actually mean? Sorry.
Well, the thesis is the thing you hand in.
Yeah. What's the difference between a thesis and a dissertation?
Well, call it the same.
Okay. Mm. Like it's, struggling out there from that point of view. And the other, just clarifying, I think we've been given three words of in what we've been developing in the stuff on, and like research problem, research issue, research question. And it's kind of in here, but it's not quite.
Well, see, that's another way of doing it.
I'm not saying that
this is better than what Dennis proposes whatever. But there are different ways of doing it, and this is one that I think is good. I think sometimes I find that a bit mechanical somehow, although this is mechanical. So. It's just another way of doing it, but
I'm just trying to.
But in the long run, it should answer all the same questions.
Coming back to what you said, Creswell has a good little funnel of those where you start off with topic, problem, issue, and you finish with question, and it sort of just funnels it down. I find that a good framework.
Mm.
Oh yeah,
and it's doing what this says and exactly what you're saying.
Well, I mean, I think the key thing is the funnel structure rather than how you label clearly that's in Graham's presentation. And somebody once said to me, by the time I get to the end of the first chapter, I should be saying, well, of course that's what they want to research, given...
That's right. That should be implied.
Yeah.
That should come through, yeah. Another thing that was a problem in the research proposal is you had to say why this stuff is really important. And people had all this banging and big drum about how wonderful the thing was. And I thought, well, look, don't say that, because they're going to keep you to that. This is going to be profoundly significant for Catholics. You don't. That's a judgment that they should make, and you can make a few hints as to why it's important later. But I would not go for this business of trying to say how important it is. That should just come through if you've done it well. It should be... it's implied importance is what you want to get across, rather than telling the reader this is important or it's going to be significant. Now, sometimes you can list your research questions systematically, sometimes you can put in a paragraph, but somewhere or other in there you need to give a very brief account of what you're going to do, whether it's data collection with questionnaire and so on, and there'll be a systematic literature review or whatever, but don't give it away. Don't give away your answers yet. You have to tell the story over the whole thesis, and you don't want to give away your results in this chapter. A couple of other mechanical things in the first chapter will be, towards the end, a brief note on what's going to follow in the remaining chapters, and that gives the reader a sense of the trajectory that you're taking in this thing, that you know where you're going, and they can then tick things off as they go along. If you don't do that, they may start guessing as to what you're going to do, and they may make the wrong guess. Some also will put in a glossary of terms, keeping it brief, because on some occasions you may need to do a more documentary study of some of those terms in your literature review, but just enough to show what you're going to work with. Some might also put in something about the context of the study. Supposing you're doing a case study in a particular school, you might describe its socio-economic area and its size and whether it's co-ed and all that sort of stuff. Sometimes people will put in a separate chapter on this, a short chapter on the context and so on. And there are all these sorts of possibilities, but that's something else that you might attend to.
Do you put a glossary in the thesis or as a...
I'd put it in the thesis, but you could put it in the appendix.
Appendix.
Mm. If you think it's a bit big or a bit irritating or interrupts what you're doing, put it in the appendix.
I actually, in my thesis many moons ago, because I was developing some new labels for things, I actually also put a little card in that the reader could move through the thesis with so they could set anything. So it was in the thesis, but it was also on a card, so...
Okay, so you had that stuck on one of the pages?
Yeah, stuck in a pocket at the back
right.
of the thesis.
Oh, okay.
Yeah.
Yeah, that's handy.
How did that work?
Well, basically, the first time you mentioned the glossary, you say there is a copy of this on a card in the back of the pocket. So as you're reading the thesis, if you're not sure what
that's
word,
right. Yeah.
You just pick up the card.
Okay.
It's like the holy pictures.
That's right.
And
you
can use it as a bookmark.
Yeah.
Yeah.
It's just a bit hard to get your head around when you're thinking digitally there with a card.
That's right.
What you did
say
is
that's right.
Yeah.
We chiselled it in the
book. Okay. Now, just something about the literature review. If you have signalled the issues correctly in your first chapter, you know, these are the big issues, they should give you cluster areas to work on in your literature review. And also what's starting to emerge then is there's some congruence. You've raised issues. Now, if you come to the literature review and you never mention those issues again, something's wrong. Do you understand? So you only put in ones that you are going to develop. And you have to show in your literature review some real competence with the areas that you look at, that you've covered it reasonably well. If there are a lot of areas on your topic and you can't handle them all, make a list of them and say the scope of the study will be limited to just looking at these 6 out of the 20. So you've got to cover your tracks and say why you won't cover all the things. I think you have to be careful that you do give adequate attention to the main areas. I have one student and I said to her, look, what you've got in these two areas, which I believe are crucial to your thesis, is too thin. You've got about 4 paragraphs. And not being dogmatic, I said, you can put it in and run the risk, but if I were an examiner, I'd send it back and say it's not enough work done in these areas. It's no use saying this needs more research. Do you understand? Mm-hmm. I mean, one of the areas was youth spirituality and the other one was values education, and there's so much around on that that you need to show you've looked at the literature, you've got a few ideas. Now, the thing is, when you do a literature review, the first thing you usually do is you copy down all the things you've read and all you've learnt. It's like a descriptive thing. But that's not enough. What a good literature review does is it makes some sort of evaluative judgment about what you've come up with. You know, is it adequate? Is there something wrong? Is there something missing? You can synthesise, you can draw conclusions. And I'm all in favour of using dot points to summarise some things, and even lists in a table. I have some colleagues who won't let the students use dot points. They say it must always be written in paragraphs. I don't understand that. I think you've got to make it as clear and as self-evident, and sometimes I find that very useful. I mean, sometimes in a literature review, you can make up a big table and you can say, there are three clusters of writings here. These ones all focus on this, and then you might have a column notes where you can put any little observation. And so you can synthesise a lot of information rather than go through and crank out what everybody says. I think a reader finds something that can synthesise and deal with things with more generalisations. That's insight. That's what a good literature review would do. And another thing that you can often ask in a literature review is, okay, you've described what they've said, so what? What does it mean? What's the issue involved here? Can you critique some of the things that you've read? Another view would be that contradicts this would be that sort of thing. So you have to demonstrate that you've got some insightful mastery of the areas that you look at. You are not simply regurgitating what you've read. And the acid test of material in your literature review is it relevant to the argument that you're going to develop or that your data you're going to collect? Because I don't see any point in having in something in the literature review that never comes up again later. And I have one student who is, his topic is, what do religion teachers understand as successful teaching of religion? Now, it's a very subtle thing because it's not saying, rate how important you think are all of these diocesan aims for religion, which are like the normative official purpose. Everybody says they're important. But when you say, what's really successful, it gets at their understanding of what the thing is indirectly. And we found that if they're teachers who are postgraduate specialists, you know, they will tend to pick the more sophisticated aims. Whereas if somebody's been dragooned into teaching religion because they said, if you want the job, you've got to teach religion, and they're looking for the first opportunity to get out, their idea of success is, can I survive the lesson today without stress? Do you see? And so it was just a very, I guess, not tricky, but subtle way of trying to get at what people really think, rather than rate these existent aims. And so what happens is, when it comes to the official aims, like I mentioned these before, catechesis, evangelism, they say, oh yeah, they're terribly important. Then we ask the question, are they helpful? They say, no, they're not helpful at all, they're confusing. And so what he's found is, rating something as important is not incompatible with thinking that it's useless. I found that an interesting thing, because people are revering these terms because of their authoritative basis, and they're afraid of criticising them because it might cost them their job. They might get in, you know, people are afraid of criticising publicly anyway. So they're just a few things about the literature review. I could go on further, but the point I wanted to make with David's thesis is he looked at an area of literature and then he said, now, from that area, you would expect that the following would be the implied indicators of success. So it was like he drew a conclusion from that area, so that if that's your view of teaching religion, okay, you know, it's got to be the catechism, we've got to learn it off by heart. He had a few little indicators. Then he was able to show that these indicators were covered by his questionnaire items. So it was a nice little neat way of going from issue to literature review to indicators to questionnaire items. So you could see that he was really drawing a conclusion from this chunk of literature review, and this was the sort of indicator that he was going to look for in some of these questionnaire items. So sometimes you can do that, And I think that adds to this sense of, you know, this is woven together, and all these things are sort of congruent from chapter to chapter. Okay.
Can I just interrupt? It might be a really ignorant question, I don't know, but if you're just, like, I'm at the stage of just finishing the 707, so I'm I know that my lit review, probably I'm going to have to revisit it.
That's normal.
Okay, so at what stage, how detailed or how, I know it's not going to be effective now, because I know I haven't done the research, so I don't know what I'm missing.
I think that's normal. You get to the end of the thesis and you say, look, this whole thing is so damn clear. Why didn't I see this at the start?
Yeah.
Do you understand it? And so it may well be you've got to rejig it.
Yeah, okay. So if I come to a proposal knowing that, is that still okay?
I think you put in what you've got at the proposal, because it's a proposal. People aren't expecting the final thesis. Mm. And often your first stage is you write it up, you just get down what you've learned, what you've read. Then you can cluster it a little bit. Mm. Then you can draw some conclusions. This is like the wisdom you have when you've done a few of them. Do you understand?
Yeah.
And so you can't sort of put the cart before the horse. You have to do the slog through. But I do think that if you've got this in mind, you'll be looking to synthesise in your literature review, and you'll be looking to say, well, how can I get a bit of information on this? Or you might even say, well, look, this isn't going to be a really big area of the literature review, so I'll do it quickly, make it brief.
Yeah.
But so that's where I think something like this can work back and help you do it. But it won't be perfect straight off. And people always have to go back and tidy it up. And some people, for example, this thesis I'm talking about, his literature review was disastrous. It was all over the place. But when he got the data and saw what the issues were, he said, well, I better go back and read up on these issues. So now he's covered his thing. And when you read it, you think, this is brilliant. He's picked up all these ideas and then he's gone after them. Whereas the things have come up out of the data and they've said, well, that literature review is not adequate to cover this. And when he comes to write it up now, he's realising that there are more references relevant to what he's doing than he anticipated before. So that's how I think something like this can help. Now,
could I just ask you, in the instance of case studies, that approach, issues tend to only emerge, don't they,
after the study? Yeah. So that's a different approach. It's more you're not sure what you're going to look for, because you're going to take a very detailed look at what's going on and things are going to emerge. This is a bit different. But then again, when you do that, you'll have to make sure that some of the things that have come up, you look up the literature on those later.
I see.
Do you see what I mean?
Yeah.
I can't think of an example, but say something that you didn't know was going to become important did, then you'd have to try to cover that to some extent.
And then you put it in the review in retrospect?
Yeah.
So that literature review chapter is always being...
It's always revised in the light of what emerges later on.
Okay.
Because if you write a literature review that doesn't relate to your results, it somehow isn't relevant enough, I think. Sometimes you do a literature review and you arrive at all the answers. You know what the answers are. Then you just set it up to validate your... That's what happens sometimes, because you don't always find out remarkably new things. You often have a good idea of what's going to happen. Sometimes it really is that. Your thesis is getting data to support your hunches. You know, it's unlikely that you do a statistical analysis and you find out something that's totally mind-blowing. Usually that doesn't happen. You've got a fair idea, I think. But that's a different style. Now, just something, I'm conscious of the time, so I'll try to up pace a bit. The presentation of data, it's got to be objective, make use of tables, and then you probably need something like a paragraph or two, if you've got a cluster of data, to say the high scores here are saying this, or it's like, and I've got some examples of it in there, it's like drawing the attention of the reader to what's prominent in your data. You're not explaining it yet, but you're signalling something that you're going to get on the bandwagon about the next chapter, right? Because you can't anticipate that they'll look through a page of tables and pick out the key things. Sometimes you might put asterisks on the ones that have got high scores that you want to draw attention to and so on. Okay, I could say a lot more about the data, but I'll leave that. Now, the next one, chapter 5.
Can I just ask a question? Because I've been reading that I'm leaving, and I write a vision. And you said that if you looked at some big main issues in your literature review, then when you're organising your data, they're probably going to be similarly clustered.
That's a difficult one. I tend to think that your initial data reporting will need to cluster things, but I tend to keep it roughly in the order of your questionnaire. If it does deal with areas, sometimes there's a questionnaire where they just mix up a whole lot of items. In that case, you cluster the items according to theme, and they're not necessarily in the same order, but you deal with it that way. But generally, keep to the structure of your research question, your research instrument. So you do the questionnaire first, then you do, say, interview, qualitative data, if you've got any of that. Now, the next chapter, you've got a little bit more scope to zero in on the big issues that have emerged, rather than simply go back and follow exactly the same structure that you have in the data. You've got more scope. But remember, it's still got petrol lines. You're still tied to your data, because that's what this chapter is about, explaining it. So you still need to keep roughly in touch with the structure you followed before. But in the last chapter is where you cut loose. And in some of the notes that I've got there, I've tried to suggest that this is where you write with at least those last two chapters two different colours. And there may be a fantastic quotation that somebody's made in your data that you say, this is a real pearl, I'm going to keep this for the last chapter because it's so colourful. When you're quoting somebody else, you can afford to be exaggerated and colourful because it's not you, do you understand? And sometimes you can get a really smashing quotation that says it all in a nutshell, the point that you're trying to make. And so that's the artistic part of writing those last two chapters. Save the pearls and the punchlines for the end, because there are some things that it's possible to say in the second last chapter that might be better said in the last chapter as a really big punchline. And I've tried to explain that a little bit in those notes. And if I just show you some of this, the one mark number 3, probably won't read through it, but what I've suggested there is this question about the language of religious education. So in chapter 1, you pose, this might be a problem. Chapter 2, what have the bods out there said about this problem? And maybe, but then again, don't give them your answer. Do you understand? In the literature review, you say, this needs to be clarified, this needs further research or whatever. Then I think you can see that we've suggested a few questions for the questionnaire that are going to answer that problem. And I told you about the result. They endorsed all those first ones, saying, yes, catechesis is important, evangelization is important. Yes, but I don't understand what the hell they mean. I scored highly, and that these terms are not confusing. And then there's you might say something about the interview results. So chapter 4, reports on the data, and there's a suggestion of what words might be used. It's just to give you a practical example of different styles of writing for each of the chapters. For example, in the last chapter, I think you would be you should be wary of saying the data says, or the teacher said, or the participant said. That's reporting stuff that should have come earlier. And then right at the end in chapter 6, you can see what we've tried to put in there are examples of the big picture issues where you can say something about. You're going to say, well, it's no use having all these religious terms if they're confusing. Schools maybe should put a moratorium on them and explain what they mean in terms that's not going to confuse anybody. Can you see you're cutting loose a bit, you're making generalisations, and then you'll have some recommendations and for the authorities and recommendations for further research. So I'll leave that, and you might look at that yourself sometime later as an example to try to highlight the different styles. Now, item four, on the left-hand side,
Graham, can I just get back one?
Yeah.
You seem to keep avoiding chapter three and the research stuff. In the way you've talked, whether you...
Oh, the methodology, I forgot to do that.
You're right.
It wasn't avoided.
I just forgot.
Okay, because it's interesting you say it seems to become de rigueur that something said about all these things.
Yeah, and I think I've seen some people write an enormous amount about epistemology and theoretical framework, and then they go into symbolic interactionism. Then you read the rest of the thesis and say, I've never seen symbolic interactionism in any of this.
Well, that's what I'm running into it. Like the people, you know, the ones that are being sent to us to read, people actually look like they're enjoying writing about the methodology. You know?
Well, see, I haven't got a clue
they're talking about.
It's a research culture thing. That's, I've said there, it's sort of become like de rigueur.
That's not bad, you say.
And
that.
So I say to people, well, make sure you've got something in there because you're covering all the bases. But I suggest to the people that I work with, don't overdo it. I think having an epistemology and these theses I'm talking about is they're looking at teachers' interpretations of the meaning of what they're doing. So interpretivism and constructionism are epistemologies and frameworks that are suitable to this sort of study, and that's what you've got to show. And I think there's a place for that, because you're then talking in the rest of the thesis about their interpretations and evaluating interpretations.
But that makes sense. Part of my tension, which I think might be affecting what you're saying, is too, there seems to be a pattern or a model that seems to be emerging. This may be an unfair question, I don't mean it to be, but is there an ACU way of doing this as opposed to another university's approach to this? Because the thesis I'm reading from here, especially the most current ones,
all have that.
All look the same.
Yeah.
It's the McLaughlinisation of theses.
Because I don't have my head around it. Yeah. So I'm thinking, are these the boxes I'm meant to be ticking when I don't even have my head around those boxes?
Well, Dennis goes into these in a lot of detail, and I probably wouldn't go into them as much, but I can see what he's getting at, and I think it's worth putting in. It's consistent with the literature of research that's all out there, and I don't know whether other universities will rate it so highly, but you never know who your examiners are going to be. So I always say to people, you've got to do something on this and try to make it your own. But a lot of people end up looking at three or four other method chapters and paraphrasing it, because they haven't got the time to become an expert in epistemology or an expert. But you've got to understand it, and you've got to make it clear. And I think that's what it's about, that if you're dealing with interpretations, practically all the theses that I've come across have to be within that mould. You know, they're not looking at an experimental method where you give treatment A and treatment B and treatment C and you don't give any treatment D, and you know, that's the real scientific model. And it had a great emphasis in educational research in the 60s and 70s. I think part of it was all these people are just trying to get scientific status. As a scientist, I never had that trouble. But I think that it was overdone. I remember going to some potential supervisors at Macquarie, and they said, put it in terms of an empirical inquiry so I can understand it. I thought, oh my God. So fortunately, I got a philosopher and a curriculum person who didn't require me to do an empirical thesis. That was further down the track. But I think that this is a bit of a difficulty that you've noted there, John Henry, and If your thesis is more philosophical, a lot of that is a problem, but there are things in method about philosophical inquiry and documentary inquiry, and you need to find a few things on that.
There's a much more pragmatic view too, which is that that particular framework that Dennis has put in place is one that's working.
That's right.
You know, people's theses are being passed.
That's right. Yeah, and I think that's why I have all the people that I work, they've got this in there. And it's a matter of judging how much is enough. You've got to demonstrate that you're aware of the literature of these things, but some of the difficulty can be just getting your head around it, as you're saying. It takes a while to figure it out, but I sometimes leave one of the steps out. I think it'd go for epistemology, framework, and then just methods, rather than methodology and technique, or whatever it was. Yeah.
Perspective.
Being exposed to all the different views of all the different people who've got contradictory meanings of the same words, that becomes part of that. You almost feel you have to be an expert in all of that to write this chapter. Is
but
the overwhelmingness of it.
It is. It can get a bit overwhelming if you think you've got to do a lot on it. Mm. I think it requires some mastery. And I say to people, what are the core things you really need to know about this? And look at some of the ones that have passed and see what they got away with, in a sense. I think that's helpful.
Otherwise, we wouldn't be reading that at all, not knowing that area.
I think so. And it's a problem because the people usually are so damn busy coping with a full-time job, big responsibilities in doing this, and they want to read in the area that's germane to their research.
Yeah.
They don't want to become experts in research methodology.
Mm.
But the people that run all the courses are, and you have to jump through their hoops, sort of thing. And but it's negotiating, that's part of the skill. So that's why I forgot it wasn't.
The one thesis I found on my topic, the one thesis I found, that is out of North Illinois, and it's got a half a page on methodology.
Yeah.
I'm thinking about
I don't think that's good enough. I think you also need to know something about the problems and the possibilities of questionnaires, and if you're going to use an area, you've got to show you've looked up the literature on the method that you use, and so on, and you've got to be able to show why you use this rather than that, and a few things. Okay.
And that's what we're being taught.
Now, if you look at these headings here, the one on the left is an article that this person wrote on retreats. And if you run down the headings, you'll see some of it's theory, some of it's historical, some of it's practical, some of it's data, and it really is all over the shop. I mean, I don't think there's any logic in those headings run down the left-hand side. But if you look at the right-hand side, by the time the thesis got to its final chapter, it started off by saying, these are the major theoretical and educational issues. These are the issues concerned with the psychology and the dynamics and the running of retreats. These are the issues concerned with context, the school, and there are problems like mandatory reporting and all these that will affect. And then the final one is on what needs to be done in the area of resources and professional development. So it's got four little blocks, and then there's a list of the areas under each. And we've just completed an article which draws on this last chapter of the thesis. And the first little block down at the asterisk, they're the headings for the article, and we're planning to write another article. And all we have to do, really, is look at this and say which ones are we going to spend most of our time on and which ones we're going to cut short. But I think that getting your headings right controls your writing. You stop going off on tangents, you stop repeating yourself. And on page 3, there's an example of a chapter 1, and this is the one I mentioned earlier about the idea of teachers' understanding of success. So it starts off with the introduction. Then it raises 5 little cluster areas of problems, and then it says, now I'm going to look at those issues under the genre of what do you understand by success. And then something about the context, the scope, and so on. So I think you can see it's a pretty simple, straightforward chapter. The fact that the writing is then channeled into that gives it a real sort of coherence. Now, number five is this thesis on retreats. The original abstract that she wrote, again, I think was like a bee collecting pollen. It's a bit all over the place. And the abstract is simply to say, this is a little bird's eye view of the whole thesis. And if you can look there for the way the abstract ended up, it's a bit longer, but it raises the issue very briefly. It describes what was done. It gives you a hint on some of the things that were found out, and then it says something about the big issues at the end. So can you see those little things with the brackets on either side? It's really describing what the each paragraph has a function. Well, look, I've covered a fair amount of territory. I thought that it might help if you wanted to go over that in your own time. If you wish, let me know. I can put something, four or five examples of chapter ones and chapter twos, chapter threes, that I think are okay if you want to look at them. I could just put them on a website and you can pick and choose. So let me know about that. But I thought in the remainder, if we've got any more time, there might be questions, problems. I really haven't locked onto the philosophical analytical thesis, but what you need to do there is each chapter's got to have some task, whether it's this area of history or this area of literature or this issue, and then you might do three or four of those, but you've got to show in your first chapter why you're going to do these, why these four areas need to be done, then you put it all together, say at the end with your conclusions. But you have to create your own structure for a philosophical analytical thesis. And that structure's got to be made clear in relation to the issues that you raise right at the start. That's why I think chapter one is so important. If you do that well, the rest of it will help. So even if you do a rough chapter one, and if you can't get it right, it's probably telling you that you're not clear enough yet, and it takes time to, you know, to know what you're going to do. But any questions or comments? We've got a bit of time,
Billy. Yeah. Just personally, just having marked about a dozen PhD theses in my life, I'd just like to reiterate what Graham said about the first chapter. You get it, you read the first... Like, I had to read one last week, actually, and I read a half a page and I knew this was good. Mm-hmm. And the other thing that... And this is a personal thing that annoys me, is when people write the first chapter at the end, when they know everything, and make it sound like it's at the beginning. There is nothing wrong in the first chapter of saying, this is where I am now, this is where my context is, this is what I want to find out, I don't know the answers yet. Some people go back and sort of massage the first chapter at the end when they know everything, and it's, you know, and you can, it just sounds that way. That's just a personal annoyance.
It depends on how it's written. Yeah, I think you can still massage it, but...
No, I didn't mean it's massage, but I mean I to sort of go back and...
Yeah, I think it's like... You don't put all the answers
in.
Yeah,
that's what I mean.
It's still a problematic that you're trying to show, and I think that's the point Paul's making, that if you think, well, it's all wrapped up in the first chapter, what's the point of doing the thesis?
So you are looking to hook them.
Yeah, you're whetting the appetite. You're trying to get them interested. And then it's got to unfold the way you said. And can you see also, I've tried to suggest that the big issues are the things that hold the story together, and you tackle them in different ways in different chapters.
Anyway, we won't have a formal, you know, through a chair or anything. If you've got anything you want to ask, Graham, if there's anything about your own areas that you're doing, you're saying, like, you had the case study question, I think, Patty. So, I mean, if you've got anything like that you'd like to, relating to yourself, let's see.
Can I just ask a really simple question? How long do you think the thesis need to be? Because I just had a... I come from a different department, so I'm not a teacher. But in our department, so somebody has just finished and he's about to hand it in his thesis. It's about 500 pages. It's just, I mean, he wants to write a book because he's already teaching. So that's what he did. And then I read some of the other people who passed recently.
Some of them are very short, some of them are a bit longer, but this guy has done this gigantic one, and I'm thinking, well, I'm wondering, is there a standard sort of approximately...
Yeah. Gigantic is not always good.
No.
I know somebody who works here whose thesis was sent back, told to cut it in half. I remember saying to him, it's too long. And it might have been a master's thesis, but it had to be cut in half. It was a master's thesis. We shall not say who that was, Mick. But, you know, it was just too long. It had everything in it. And there is a limit to the words. And if it's going to be too long, you need to say why. I had to do that. I said, well, the areas that I'm looking at, each of them really requires a thesis. So I would argue the case to go above the, there was 100,000 we're supposed to have, and I think this went to about 100. But you had to put a case in for that, because they don't want people to think that the bigger the better.
Isn't the 80,000?
Yeah.
85
on Crystal. Well, I can't...
It'll be in that range of 80.
I've got 60 in my head for some reason. I've got 100 in the head for PhD.
I see just have a
PhD.
We haven't breached the 100, so...
No.
But a PhD, I think, can be up to 100.
Yeah. And I think that's...
Maybe it's 60 to 80, that's why.
I never count the words anyway, but...
you know when it comes in, or it's in two books. But the other way around that, Michelle, is the use of appendices.
Yeah.
Like, I got someone who had a lot of raw data from a fairly substantial questionnaire, and she was putting it in the thesis. I said,
No, that really takes away from...
Pick out a couple, you know, important ones and discuss them and...
Graham, how important is a conceptual framework?
Well, a lot of people will have a thesis and they won't mention that, but there's an implied theoretical framework in it. I find that a bit of a problem, because sometimes people will not just use symbolic interactionism or behaviourism or whatever-ism. They'll have a combination of things. And I find that's the most difficult one. And I think that epistemology is, and I'd think of the theoretical framework as something like interpretivism or something as general as that. And I wouldn't add symbolic interactionism unless you're a sociologist and you're going to go into Herbert Bloom's approach and whatever it is. Because I see people mention that and they don't. And I talked to Paul about this. You look through the rest of the thesis and you can't see any demonstration of, so why put it in?
Many of the ACU theses have this conceptual framework of a model with beams and boxes and lines and arrows.
Well, that's a different...
That's a different thing.
That's not a conceptual framework for interpreting. It's like a conceptual scheme for your literature review, and that's a good thing to start off with. I've just done it in this with the headings. You just put them in boxes, and some people like, and Michael Moroney, whose thesis went in, he's great at drawing boxes, so he'd have all these. I thought they were really good because they made it so clear what he was doing, and one of the examiners says, I'm sick of all these. So you win some, you lose some. I don't think they penalised it for it, but I thought that was very handy.
Well, that's part of clarifying in diagrammatic form, the way that's you were saying before.
See, a good literature review tells the reader where you're going to go in it, and sometimes you can do that best with a little diagram showing these are the areas, and you might say these three areas are relevant but beyond the scope of our study. So that answers one of those earlier points. So that's like a conceptual scheme rather than a theoretical framework. And I think that what happens is, and Michael got these two things confused too, they're not the same.
No.
One's the overall sociological view that you're taking, and this is just a scheme for how you're going to tackle your literature review. And I think that they're like bigger versions of what I've said about headings, that the purpose of doing that is to keep you on track, stop going off on tangents, and to stop being like a bee collecting stuff, do it systematically.
They also help the reader.
Enormously.
If I'm reading a thesis and I've gone four pages without a heading, and I'm starting to think, now where am I? How does
That's
this
right.
connect? So
yeah.
I always keep saying, imagine you're taking somebody on a journey and they don't know where they're going.
That's right.
You let them know, we're going to be turning left soon. Now we've just gone through the valley and so you just remind the reader where they're up to and headings and relatively short sections.
I think what happens to that, Meg, is that it shows you a topography of the thesis. If you just get acres and acres of print, it's like the Hay Plain, if you've ever driven across. It's just all salt bush. There's no... you've got to have something with mountains and valleys, as Mick was saying, and the headings do that. And also, if you get a page and it's all one paragraph, you get the same feeling. Don't have big, long paragraphs. Maureen, could you get five of those for Maureen?
I've got a couple of students with obsessed with, and no one here, obsessed with, at the end of their chapters, summarising what they've done in the whole chapter, and it's pretty driving me mad, but I think
it's too repetitious.
Yeah,
I didn't mention that because I think a good thesis doesn't need that. Are you presuming you're a person stupid that's reading it? What you might do in the last chapter is, these are the major conclusions from the previous chapter. But even if you're going to do that, change the wording a little bit. Make it look a bit different so that if you have a feeling, I'm sure I've read this paragraph before, it puts you off. So I would be wary of that. Maybe dot points. But I wouldn't put a summary at the end of each chapter. I think that's pedantic. But you get books that do that.
Yeah, and I always encourage people to put a summary at the end of each chapter. But the thing is, it can't... Like, if it's a 15-page chapter, then it's just a paragraph, and it's not the same words you've used.
I'm happy with that. And sometimes dot points.
Sometimes I see summaries as useful. Someone might have slabs of data, right, and they've got all these results. And then if you just leave it hanging, you sort of think, well...
No, that's right.
Then you come in and you say, like you said, you're not discussing them in the data
that's
section.
That's right. But it's
but
highlighting.
You're highlighting. Yeah. Like, you know, the ones that have some meaning here or significance here are... Well,
that's a good idea. Yeah, that's highlighting. It's data reduction.
Yeah.
It's synthesising. And it's drawing the attention of the reader to what you want them to look at. You're not expecting them to look through acres of stuff and come to the right conclusion, and I think you were saying otherwise it's left hanging.
Yeah.
So that sort of thing is good in the data.
But if someone does a summary and goes through and just restates everything that's been done, that is very annoying.
Mm. That's also true of that question. What I've sort of been encouraged, I think, but I don't know if it's just because we're working through assignments, to indicate our purpose at the beginning of each of the chapters again. And that feels to me very repetitive after we've already indicated
it can
that.
Be. It depends on how you do it. If you say the literature review will be in three major sections and it will cover these, maybe use a little diagram, I think that's good.
Mm-hmm.
Rather than just diving in, I think it's always good to have a little short introduction is good. If it's too long, it gets burdensome. But what do you think about that?
I think there's probably a case for restating, and this would be the one case where I would say always write your purpose the same way, because I've seen purpose groups happening. You know, people start in chapter one saying the purpose of this thesis is this, and then in their attempt to paraphrase, it drifts as the chapters go on. So my advice is always use the same words to state your purpose if you have to.
I think that helps. Yeah. But the thing here is stating the purpose of each chapter.
Not the research purpose all the time.
Don't do the research purposes.
Please don't put the research questions
but
at the start of every chapter.
I thought you were talking about what you're going to do in the literature.
No.
What data you're going to... what issues you're going to look at. You know, what are you going to do in the final chapter? You will look at major headings. I think that's useful.
Yeah.
But, yeah, don't keep cranking out the research questions.
I wouldn't do it as a matter of course, but when you get to your methodology or when you're arguing for a particular theoretical framework, because the purpose is this, then this is the appropriate approach.
Yeah. That's fine. Yeah.
And back to the research questions in the Lit Review, I know that the research questions come from the Lit Review. Whereabouts would you suggest they go within the Lit Review chapter?
Well, you could do it that way. That's one way of doing it. Relate the literature review to your research questions. What I've suggested in this one is that you relate it to the issues that you've raised, and they're not necessarily all research questions.
Yeah.
The research questions are how you tackle the issues.
Right.
And I tend to keep the issues as bigger headings than the research questions.
But what I'm thinking is, where would you locate your research questions?
Chapter 1. Yeah,
when your final research question. See, I tend to differ. I tend to think at the end of chapter 2. Because then you've got the foundation for them. So,
different ways of doing it. I would have thought that that's...
I would have
the
my
major
purpose.
Task.
I would have my problem and my purpose at the end of chapter 1. Then, based on the literature, I would come up with a specific research question at the end of chapter 2. But that's the way I would do it.
Based on the literature.
Using the literature review to...
Some of the,
that doesn't mean it's the right way.
It might be that that relates to the content area more, maybe.
It might too, yeah.
Well, it's sort of like being tried to just come up with a question, but some of the pieces I've been reading have got a number of...
Sub-questions
and associated that then seem to be analysed and pulled up data, from those subsequent chapters.
Yeah.
So that's...
Not out of the data.
Oh, no, but they're related to
their findings. Those sub-questions will come out of your literature review, because as I'm doing at the moment, there's other little things.
Mm. Well, see, I would have thought that the questions you ask dictate what literature you're going to look at. That's what I was looking at. But if you are going to... I find that sometimes a bit artificial, because... You know what the questions are going to be before you do that. That's why I put it in earlier. Besides, see that as driving the literature review. Certainly it expands, and it may raise other things that you will ask questions about, but I would put it in earlier as a driving thing rather than something that has emerged from the literature review. Often in practice it doesn't happen anyway, because you look at the literature on the areas that you think are going to be important.
I suppose what I'm talking about is when you get down to that really specific, fully funneled research question.
I would have thought of that as actually formulating the questions of the interview and questionnaire items, no? I'd see that as... It depends on how you do it, but that's one way of doing it. Yeah.
I think you have different ways.
Yeah.
And I think, again, different... paradigms, different areas. Of
and it may suit...
Mine's mainly maths education, so it's probably quite different.
It may suit the content.
It's not room for too much in 5 pages, is it?
The answer's
this is the enlightened principles, please.
When we went to school in Queensland, we had to cut the answers out of the back of the book and hand them all up, and I remember I kept mine, and it was always good to check.
That the kids refer to it as Bob, checking up on Bob, back of book.
Oh, back of book.
Anything else anyone would like to ask or share? Or
this is a bit of a philosophical question or an emotive one, I don't know, but Graham, what would be the best piece of advice you'd give to someone when you hit the wall and think, why am I doing this?
I'm glad you brought this
up.
That's
a very good question, actually.
I think some of the best things that I've done with the students that I've worked with is kept them sane, helped them when their kids had cancer. One almost died on me, and I've had I think being really sensitive, they're just not... I guess we should do this, and I think people do it with all the students they teach at school and so on, that you've got to realise you're dealing with people that have got lots of pressures, and I sometimes think I've got to postpone anything I want to say. I've just got to get this person over a difficult period. I would say give it a break. Don't give up. See how you feel later on. Because a number of people have been through this. And one student said to me, the only reason I'm going to finish this thesis is that you were so kind to me. Mm-hmm. And I thought, oh, that's nice to hear. Mm-hmm. But and he will get there. But he had a major illness and was off for a couple of years.
Are you talking about illness type things or things where you just
thinking,
oh my God, I've had it.
I'm just thinking, when you're spending another 10 hours on the weekend, why am I doing this?
Yeah.
I mean, and it's really easy to walk away from
it.
And
is,
and I'm just, like, I've got all these quotes on
well,
my wall.
I think that
I think
you need to
what's
be aware.
What's the thing that keeps you going?
Yeah. I think you've got to be aware and somehow address all those other personal things. The other thing is you've got to acknowledge that it is a very lonely, it's like that film The Loneliness of the Long Distance Runner. You really are by yourself. It's not the same as being in a class, and you have to be like a dog with a bone. And I think we all get to that thing where you do say, why am I doing this? Because it's so time-consuming, and it's often the thing you get to when everything else in your week has to be done. And I don't know what the simple answer is. I don't think there is one, but hopefully a group like this coming to these things, you know, well, I'm not the only long-distance runner.
And that's the thing, especially when you finish the course, because we had a great group that kept you going.
Yeah.
And when you finish those 2 years and courses, you are the long-distance runner. That's why, you know, you just soak up every colloquium you can, soak up every one of these you can, because it's just so important.
I think a lot of contact with your supervisor, even if you just bring them up each week.
The answer to is that what you're getting is the highest academic qualification that exists. It is gold medal, elite. And so it is. When you, that's it.
I just thought, I know you said you had a good collegial group. Have you thought about creating meeting times?
Yes, we tried to have dinner together. And
sometimes meet and read each other's.
I guess the group just sort of was an external structure that got us together.
Yes, of course.
I think that's got a lot of people through the EDD.
Yes.
I think the dropout rate for PhD is higher. I'm not sure, but they're more alone if you're doing that. Because often you don't get in and become part of a group. But I've got people in Auckland, in Lismore, in Adelaide, and they're all over the place. And telephone is, I suppose phone bills have gone up, and often you can't ring them during the day, but that's helpful, I think. Better than emails, because emails are somehow impersonal, particularly if there's a sensitive problem thing. And you know, as supervisors, sometimes you'll devastate people's stuff and you want to say, look, this is going to feel like devastation, but it's like cough medicine. It's designed to help. I don't get any pleasure out of this. And that can be important, because when you get your work back and it says, you know, this is a third-rate politician's first speech, it hurts and you feel devastated because you're conscious of all the time put in, but you have to get over that. And I find it important to say to people, I'm going to tear your stuff apart a lot, but it's not personal. It's to make it better, and if you can't deal with that, well, we shouldn't work together on it. So do that at the start, because I think a lot of criticism to make it better is much healthier than getting it back from an examiner saying do it again. Or
and then you've got to get your head into it again.
Yeah.
It's better while your head's in it. I totally agree.
When I first started, I was working with Graham, and I can just testify to all that you said, Graham. That real sensitivity to, you know, times when you were, well, I was, you know, not able to, to keep it up. But I do remember you saying, be surgical with it, you know, I'll be surgical. And I've always stuck to that. So when I give material to people, I expect you to be surgical with this now. Sort of like it takes away your vulnerability. So you, that's how I was learning in it.
Yes. I think that is important. I don't think any supervisor will claim to be infallible, but I have some students and they say, that hurts, but it's right. I have another student and I said, this is too thin, and this person said, no, it's not, it's all covered. I said, well, you know, you're going to take a risk on this. But I can't really tell that student, help that student, as much as somebody who says, look, I'm a bit lost, what can we do? If people are sort of, in a sense, arrogant about what they're doing, you can't tell them anything. And I, you know, I don't need to tell them if they don't want to hear sort of thing. But I think that we all learn by getting critiques of what we write. When you become an academic, sometimes you don't get that unless you get an article that's rejected or something. And you always need it. I still need it. People need to look at it because you get so attached to what you write. And I don't want to delete anything. And I'm a killer. I'm picking repetition in what anybody else writes. But I'm not so sensitive to it myself.
That's where the repetition thing too is something when you're reading that is avoided.
Yeah.
And the headings thing, I believe, is the great way to avoid that. That when you're planning, get your headings like Graham said, and then even under those little dot points, and then if you follow them, you're not going to be jumping from there back to there,
This is what I do. I get the computer to read it, and then I listen to it
games,
in the car.
And at their lunch table,
so
I
spend an hour and a half driving every day. So I've been doing this for 25 years now. You can get programs to read them onto a tape, and there's a now program called Text Speaker, and you put it on your computer and it reads it onto an MP3 file on your computer. You don't even have to record it. Then you can put it on an iPod or on a CD and listen to it in the car. If it doesn't sound good, you've got to change it. If it sounds good, you say, that's real smooth, you know you've got somewhere. And I revised our whole book over 2 years listening to it in the car, so I'm sick of that voice. But that's very helpful.
Just run past that technology again, Graham.
Well, that one is from one of the speech recognition programs, Dragon, but I don't like the voice on that, so that one is from an older program called ViaVoice. It's a more tolerable voice. But the other one is called Text Speaker. Text Speaker. And you get it from a place called DeskShare, DeskShare. I had problems making it work, and I had to send back and ask for help twice. But they seem to have... You do some tiny little tweaking inside the thing called Program Data Prevention Execution. I could tell you how to do that now. But I find that good because I listen to lots of articles, I hear people's chapters... and I just have been doing this for so many years now. I enjoy driving to work. I go the longest distance, drive slowly and just enjoy or get angry at whatever I'm listening to.
How do you make notes while you're listening
to it? I put my notes on the digital recorder and then they turn them into text when I get to work.
There's a text reader on Microsoft 7.
Yeah, there
there's
is.
There's an option there that you can just...
Yeah.
You've got the iPad there, and I nearly did it last night, and you can really read it to me.
Yeah, I haven't learned how to do that, because I found these other ones.
There.
But, yeah, there's you can use the ones that are there already, but the one that puts it into an MP3 file is good, because you can get lots of articles and just turn them into something and make CDs of them and listen to them.
So when I was presenting my proposal, I had an MP3 and it was recording. Ron Van Vliet helped me with this, so that's why I can't explain it that well, but it recorded it and then it downloaded it onto my computer
but it's still audio.
It's a sound file, yeah.
Now, what I was really wanting it to do was go into text on the computer. Is that possible?
Well, the thing is that those programs require a specific voice and headphones or a tape-recorded version of your voice.
Mm.
When you've got 10 people speaking, I don't think you can make Dragon, which is the common one, accurate enough to do that, and it wouldn't be as good a recording. Like, if you hold this there, you get a good... It wouldn't work for years, but I found the new one and Dragon, it's pretty accurate. At least I can recognise what it is and tidy it up. But
one of my advancement in this area was last Saturday, and I bought a $20 microphone from Dick Smith, and this is a reasonably new computer, so it's got sound capacity. But so we actually use it in a day on Saturday, and I sat it there, and people, because I'm getting ready to do interviews, so mine is now like this picked up all the very clearly 10 people in the room, or 6 people in the room, and 6 or 3 metres away.
Yeah.
Clearly, so we were very surprised.
But as an audio file.
But as an audio file,
yeah.
But at least in terms of the interviewing exercise,
yeah.
The bloke at Dick Smith's trying to say to me there's another program for the sound, which lets you then start to edit it as well, way beyond what word thing does.
Yeah, but that would still be editing it as an audio file.
Yep.
Yeah.
Yeah, but it's still on the audio. That's something I didn't know last week.
Yeah. But what some people do is they put headphones on, and then they put an earphone on, listen to their interview, and then speak it again clearly with their own microphone, and that goes in pretty accurately with Dragon.
That's a good idea.
As long as you do it in a quiet room.
Mm.
Yeah. But I found I can go to the library and I can read on bits of books that I've read and all that sort of stuff and come back and it comes off very clearly.
Mm.
In the car, it's got a little bit more background noise, but it's still pretty accurate.
Mm.
And I do drive more carefully when I...
So can you download Dragon or you have to buy it?
It only costs about $180. You get it in a packet and it has a microphone, headpiece microphone with it.
Dragon.
Yeah, Dragon, naturally speaking, preferred, I think it's called. And it works with Olympus digital files as well. So if you get the latest Dragon one, which I think is 10, you can use a microphone or you can use a digital tape recorder for your stuff. And I just can't do without them now. I often make digital files by just reading someone's chapter and saying, this is terrible, or whatever, and sending it to them. And it's the smallest file. It's much smaller than MP3. It's about a third the size of an MP3 and 15th the size of a WAV file. So I just keep going for 3 or 4 minutes at a time when we have phone conversations. Some people want to keep our conversations as they go back over it.
Mm.
If they don't need it, they throw it away. But we usually record every telephone conversation we have or every meeting.
And then you can
email. I just send it to them,
file.
Yeah. Mm.
Wow. I'm using my phone, I'll do it like that with the recorder.
Yeah, they may, yeah.
That I can then plug in and save onto the computer.
Yeah.
Because you know how you're walking and you have these thoughts?
Yep. No, look, that's not funny. That's clever.
Yeah.
Sometimes you wake up in the middle of the night with a really good idea, and I find if I don't write it down, I forget it.
And I think that the writing is one way of clarifying and sorting and thinking, but I think having to articulate it clearly, even if you're just rehearsing it yourself, it actually shapes and sorts things.
Every time you explain what you're doing to somebody else, it gets clearer.
Mm-hmm.
Because you struggle to try to make it clear to the person and you make it clearer to yourself.
Mm-hmm.
You sometimes find when you're teaching something, you understand it more clearly as you're doing it. Well, I hope some of that gives you something to think about, but there may be still a few more questions. Maybe
anything else now?
Just wanted to add one thing. Those who have Windows Vista program, they have built-in speech recognition.
Oh, good.
Yeah.
you just have to click disable, you know, the for voice disabled people sound. You know, it recognizes your voice straight away, so you don't have to spend money.
So you've got to have Word 7 and Vista.
Yes, Windows Vista.
See, I'm antediluvian. I'm still on, you know,
well, I don't know.
Vista
at home.
My
phone's plugged into an iPod.
I am a user of technology I need, but I'm still behind on lots of other things.
Okay, well, then we'll formally bring this to close. I'd like you all to